Members, today is Monday, March 3rd, and the time is 1 o'clock. I call this meeting of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee to order. And members, we have a quorum. Representative Knutson, have you had a chance to look at the minutes, and would you like to move their approval?
I would, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Knutson moves approval of the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those against say nay. The motion prevails, and the minutes are approved. Okay, first of all, better late than never. Representative Rapisky has treats for us from last time, so he thinks we're not very sweet, it looks like, but we'll take that, okay? So thank you very much, your representative. Here's what we're doing today. Updates and budget presentations from the health-related licensing boards. So we have several of them on the agenda. We will bring up the boards in order listed on our agenda, and we will pause for questions for each board once they finish their presentation. So basically, it's going to be about 12 to 14 minutes per board. For us to be able to get done on time. So with that, three of the boards were unable to join us, and they have submitted written testimony included in your package. First up is Samantha Strollo. Hopefully I got that right. And please state your name officially so we have it on the record correctly. And then, of course, which board you're with. And we would ask to keep your presentation to about 5 to 7 minutes. That way there's room for questions. So 5 would be better than 7, so we can just ask those many questions that we've always wanted to ask. So go ahead, please, submit. Go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Backer, members of the committee. My name is Samantha Strollo, S-T-R-E-H-L-O. I am the Executive Director with the Minnesota Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy. I wanted to thank you for having the Health Regulatory Licensing Boards here today to talk a little bit about our agencies. Several of my colleagues are here with me today to present information regarding the boards that they represent. Before getting into specifics about my agency, I did want to give a general overview of the health regulatory licensing boards in Minnesota, who we are, what we do. So for those of you who are not familiar with the health regulatory licensing boards, there are 16 health-related regulatory boards in Minnesota. We are executive branch non-cabinet agencies. We have staff members and board members. Board members are both professional and public members, and are appointed by the governor. The boards were created by the legislature to protect the public. The board's main functions are to issue licenses to those who are qualified, monitor compliance with license renewal and continuing education requirements, investigate complaints and take disciplinary or corrective action when warranted, and to educate the public and licensees about what we do and the complaint resolution process. The boards regulate approximately 340,000 health professionals in Minnesota. We all have separate practice acts for our respective professions, and our agencies are independent state agencies. Minnesota Statutes Chapter 214 also establishes shared programs, including the Administrative Services Unit, the Criminal Background Check Program, and the Health Professional Services Program. It is important to note we are all fee-funded. What that means is we are not funded by the general fund. Rather, we are funded by the fees we collect from applicants and licensees that are then deposited in the state government special revenue fund. At this point, I'll share a little bit more about the agency that I represent. The Minnesota Board of Behavioral Health and Therapy was created in 2003. We regulate professional counselors, professional clinical counselors, and alcohol and drug counselors. Professional counselors are mental health counselors employed in a variety of settings who provide mental health counseling services to Minnesota citizens. Alcohol and drug counselors provide counseling services to persons seeking services to address substance use issues. I believe you have in your information our change item requests that were included in the governor's recommended budget. The first is an increase to our base budget to add a full-time position. Every year, the number of individuals we regulate continues to increase. In the last 10 years, the number of individuals we regulate has more than doubled. In 2014, BBHT regulated approximately 4,000 individuals. As the beginning of this year, we regulate almost 10,000 individuals. Each fiscal year, BBHT receives approximately 1,000 new license applications. With this growth, workload for staff continues to increase, which is why we are requesting an additional position. It's important to note that the board is currently collecting sufficient revenue through the fees we collect to cover this increase to our base budget. The second change item request that you have is for a new fee. Last session, legislation passed that established Minnesota as a member of the Counseling Compact. The Counseling Compact allows professional counselors to apply for a privilege to practice in any state that is also part of the compact. The Counseling Compact is not currently issuing privileges in any state, but they do anticipate going live late this year or early next year. The compact language allows BBHT to collect a fee from individuals who reside outside Minnesota who apply for a privilege to practice professional counseling in Minnesota. BBHT is looking to establish this fee and is requesting language that would allow us to collect up to $100 per application for a privilege to practice in Minnesota. This fee will be used to cover any BBHT costs associated with the counseling compact. This includes the information I have to share with you today. Thank you for the opportunity to present, and I welcome any questions you may have.
Thank you. Questions from members? I do have a question. Are you, Director, are you seeing over the years, what changes are you seeing in behavioral health and therapy from the individual's boots on the ground? That would be my first question. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Representative or Chair Backer. I would say the increase, especially after COVID, in the use of telehealth is one of the big things. That's what sort of led to the creation of that counseling compact. I think we're all aware that citizens in rural Minnesota have access issues. So this is one tool that we hope will address those issues in both telehealth options, but also people who live in border, along the border, because then they may be able to utilize professionals from other states that are right across the border.
Yeah, thank you. And that was going to be my second question. I know Representative Kuehler and I live right on the border of North Dakota and South Dakota and so forth. Is most of your services then for behavioral health when you get out west or up north or down south telemedicine, or what percentage are you starting to see that as? Go ahead, please.
Chair Backer, I guess I don't have any specific numbers. I would say that most of our licensed individuals are located in the Twin Cities area. As you get into outstate Minnesota, you see less and less numbers of licensed counselors. As far as those seeking services, those are just numbers that I don't have.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Chair Backer, to the testifier. I'm just curious, have you had much experience, or has your division heard much about, like, when someone's in crisis, are we able to treat them at the scene or use telemedicine for that, especially in our outstate areas? How's that progressing? I know it's out there. Is it working? Is it positive, or is it something we have to scrap? Thank you.
Go ahead,
Chair Backer.
Yep, go ahead.
Representative Hewitt, that's not really in our area of expertise, so I wouldn't feel comfortable answering that question. We do license the individuals, but we don't create any sort of like crisis programs or anything like that.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Oh, Representative Doe.
Thank you, Chair Backer. I was just reading one of the change items, and this is great. I think up until you normally have had 4,000 licenses that have increased to 9,400 licenses for behavioral health. Tell me where that growth is. I mean, we don't see that very often. Where in the healthcare industry, we're always looking for people to come in and finding better ways. Tell me why there's so much growth in behavioral health.
Go ahead, Director.
Chair Backer, Representative Nadeau. I don't have the exact reason why that's happening. I think that we're just making mental health services more available to citizens of Minnesota. I think also we have continued to expand on the importance of mental health services, which I think has then led more individuals to want to go into those professions. So I wish I had we've been doing this and it's been working great. I just think that as a state, we've been doing a good job in expanding mental health services to individuals.
Thank you.
Okay, we're at our 12-minute mark here. So we'll end with one more question, the last question, Representative Keeler.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for addressing the border city question. I guess my question is one level deeper. I know in greater Minnesota, we also have our tribal nations. Can you talk a little bit about how you partner with our tribal nations for the more culturally inclusive mental health healing practices that we participate in?
Tribal nations.
Go ahead, Director.
Oh, excuse me. Chair Backer, Representative. Under tribal jurisdiction, we don't require individuals to be licensed under tribal jurisdiction, and so we don't have much interaction with the tribes. I would say on the alcohol and drug counseling side of things, there is an entity, it's called UMACAD. I don't remember what it stands for, but we have been working closely with them to offer reciprocity to individuals. It is a tribal certification body, and we have been partnering with them to offer reciprocity licensure so those individuals can obtain alcohol and drug counselor licensure.
Okay. I was in error. We have our final question from Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Director Strelo. Just the following up on Representative Nadeau's question about the numbers that have gone increased so much, and I was just curious if you have any data about how Minnesota compares to other states per capita. I know, and when we talk about mental health in schools, there's always these numbers we float around, counselors to student body, and I'm just curious what other states compare, how we compare, if you have that data.
Go ahead, Director.
Chair Backer, Representative, I don't have that data right in front of me, but I can certainly look into that and get that to you all.
Appreciate that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you so much. We appreciate you coming in front of us. Next on deck is Paul Bacon, Executive Director. And then after Mr. Bacon, we have Dr. Ridge Piddle. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that correctly. So if not, state your name, where you at, and about 5 minutes, please.
Chair Backer, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Paul Bakken. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Board of Podiatric Medicine. We've been around since about 1917, and our mission is to protect the public health, safety, and welfare of the Minnesota public by extending the privilege to practice to qualified individuals, regulating continuing medical education, and receiving and investigating complaints against our licensees regarding their professional conduct. We serve two primary groups of licensees. On the one hand, we have our doctors of podiatric medicine, the DPMs. And on the other hand, we have prosthetists, orthotists, podorthists, fitters, and assistants. Nobody ever says the whole thing. We have an acronym, PAPFA. Everybody just says PAPFA.
PAPFA.
Between those two licensees, we also have, at any given time, about 24 temporary permits for people going through residency programs here in Minnesota, and our fair share of professional firm registrations through Chapter 319B. We're here today to ask for your help and support in raising our fees. The last time we raised our fees was back in 1999. So that does beg the obvious question, how have we been able to operate over the last quarter of a century without raising fees? And the answer is with progressively increasing difficulty. Our board has held the line for as long as we can against raising our fees, but a fee increase is now necessary. Our appropriation, we're not asking for an increase in our appropriation. The appropriation that this body has approved as a part of the governor's budget in the past is entirely appropriate to supporting the high level of services that our board offers. Our difficulty is that our current fee structure is insufficient to raise enough revenue to fulfill that appropriation. As things stand now, we have about a $41,000 a year deficit. So the fee increase for which we're asking to raise that ceiling authority would get us back to where we need to be. Over the last 2 years, we've been drawing down on our operating reserve fund. Without any change, that reserve fund will be depleted at the end of another 4 years. So I could go on, but that's what we do. You know, every year we review and audit about 6,200 hours of continuing medical education. We receive a variable number of complaints with our increased service level. When I first took on my position, we had some complaints that had been pending for over 2 years. Over the last 2 years, we've cleared the deck. We have two cases that are under continual supervision under an agreement for corrective action. And I was prepared to come here today to say that we had a completely clear deck on complaints and discipline, but 3 minutes before I left my office to come to this meeting, we got a new one in the mail. So the process continues. I think that concludes my presentation. Out of respect for the committee's time, I'll conclude and stand for questions.
Thank you. Question member, okay. Representative Lehman, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for being here today. And I'm just not sure I fully understand your situation. So if you haven't raised the fees for 25 years, have you had the same appropriation for the 25 years?
Mr. Bacon.
Chair Backer, Representative, the appropriation has increased slowly and regularly over the years. The fees just haven't kept up. There's surprisingly little control that we have over our budget. A lot of the items are mandated by statute and service providers that we're required to use. For example, all of our IT services have to come from Minute. Those increase every year. All of our legal services have to come from the Attorney General's office. They don't do it for free. We get charged just like from a law firm. So the appropriation has increased regularly. It's just the fees that haven't been increased since 1999.
Follow-up? Representative?
Okay. I think that's it, Mr. Chair. I'm still, I think, a little bit confused, but I'm not really even sure what to ask.
Okay. Well, that's fair. Honesty is good. Great. Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Mr. Bakken, for coming. So my question is, I'm a little surprised to hear that you have a reserve fund. What's the purpose of it, and how does it? Do you use the appropriation of it, or is it from user fees or assessments by from your DOC?
I'm Director Bachman.
Chair Backer, Representative Carroll, excellent question. We receive no general funding. Everything we do, it comes from the fees that we charge our licensees and other stakeholders. All of the fees that we gather go into the 1201 fund, which is common to all HLBs, but we have our designated portion of that. The reserve fund, I call it a reserve fund or an operating fund. That's the fund we use to support operations throughout the year because we don't have a steady stream of income. We get most of our income in chunks throughout the year as our licensing cycles come due. So the operating fund is there to make sure that there's always funding on hand to support the costs that we have. It's also mandated by statute. We're required to have a year's worth of operating funds in that fund. And we currently don't. We're about $100,000 short.
Follow-up, Representative Carroll?
Yes. So is it a misnomer then to call it a reserve fund as opposed to an operating fund?
Director Bachman.
Yeah, Representative Backer, or Chair Backer, Representative Carroll. I suppose it would be. I mean, it's not an emergency slush fund. It's literally the fund we use for daily operations.
Okay, thank you. That makes more sense. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Representative Liebling, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe this would be for fiscal staff. Just to do all of the boards have a fund, and is it a reserve or operating, or just what is it? And does it appear on the spreadsheet somewhere?
Go ahead, Mr. Hardy.
Chair Backer, Representative Liebling, I would have to confirm and get back to you on the situation for each individual health licensing board on the requirement for that the director referenced. I would say largely what we're talking about here is the health licensing boards receive a direct appropriation, and they also collect fees. Those are two separate processes on the spreadsheet. They can collect fees, but unless they get an appropriation pursuant in law, They can't spend that amount. So it's different to think about the boards relative to other general fund spending this committee does because of the fee component being segregated from the actual appropriation that they receive.
Follow-up or additional questions here, Representative.
Okay, well, thanks, Mr. Chair. I guess I just thought that Representative Carroll's question was a good question. And, no, I'm aware of the fee and the appropriation aspect of it, although I'm a little surprised to hear that they've had an appropriation that wasn't matched by their fee income for some period of time. That's kind of a new idea to me, but I just wanted to follow up with Representative Carroll's question because I also was not aware of this operating fund kind of reserve thing and just kind of wanting to understand how that works. But maybe you could follow up, Mr. Harney.
Okay, we have Representative Van Binsbergen. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question, are the fees, do you initiate fines as well? Is that part of the process? I'm trying to understand how you're bringing in your money. And so can you levy fines for bad actors in the profession? Is that part of the way to, you know, you say you haven't gotten an increase in 25 years. I'm just trying to understand also.
Director Bachman.
Chair Backer, Representative. We do have the authority to levy fines in disciplinary cases. Fortunately, the rate of discipline in our profession is pretty low. I mean, that's good for the public. It's not great for raising revenue. The lion's share of our revenue comes from license application and renewal fees. And we also charge for primary source verifications that health insurance companies might use for credentialing providers or hospitals. Those are our two largest sources of revenue at the present time.
Follow-up, Representative?
So there hasn't been a big push for higher fees and higher fines, I should say, to the people part of the organization. Is that correct?
Director. Okay. Director Bakken.
Chair Backer, Representative, no, there hasn't. There hasn't been a push either by our board or by the trade association or our licensees to impose higher fees for disciplinary cases. Honestly, we just don't have that many.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, seeing no further. Oh, Representative Nadeau.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, but. Maybe Representative Liebling understands this better than I do, but the more this conversation has gone on, the more I've gotten confused. So what percentage of your overall budget is raised in actual license fees that the change item is proposing to increase?
Director Bakken.
Chair Backer, Representative, I can put this in perspective. Our current fee for a DPM license is $600, but that's a 2-year license, so $300 per year. The extra fee increase authority for which we're asking would raise an additional about $100,000 in revenue a year. Now that would put us solid in terms of operations and would allow us to replenish that operating fund back to the statutory requirement. I'm not sure if I answered the question, sir.
You did, somewhat.
Okay.
Just one follow-up.
Yeah, go ahead, Representative.
So you also generate revenue from credentialing and things like that. So, I mean, an additional $100,000, I think your biennial budget was, what, 527 is the proposed? Is that right?
Correct.
So, so right now, with everything the same, you're on 700 licenses, you're raising an additional $100,000, and that's going to close the gap in a $527,000 biennial budget.
Correct. Director Bakken.
Okay. Chair Backer, Representative, correct.
Okay.
That we, like I said previously, we have a structural deficit of about $41,000 per year, $82,000 over a biennium. The additional $100,000 in revenue would close that deficit gap for operations, and also give a little bit extra to start building back up that operating fund to where it's supposed to be by state statute. Okay.
Thank you, Chair Backer.
Okay, thank you. Okay, members, we are on time. Thank you so much, Director. And next is Dr. Piddle with Board of Chiropractic Examiners. And after that is Deb Schumacher with the Board of Nursing. So please come up, state your name, and about 5 minutes.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Backer and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Ridge Piddy. P-I-D-D-E is the last name. And I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Board of Chiropractic Examiners. The mission of the Board of the Chiropractic Examiners is to protect the public through effective licensure and enforcement of the statutes and rules governing the practice of chiropractic to ensure a standard of competent and ethical practice in the profession. The Board provides core public safety services through regulatory oversight to ensure both high standards of chiropractic practice and excellent customer service to the general public, consumers of chiropractic services, applicants and licensees, students and faculty in chiropractic academic programs, other state and local agencies, state and national professional chiropractic associations, and the national testing organizations, as well as the Federation of Chiropractic Licensing Boards. The board was established by legislative act in 1919 and currently has 3,374 licensed chiropractors. Licensed chiropractors also have the opportunity to maintain registrations in 5 different areas, including acupuncture, animal chiropractic, graduate preceptorship, independent examiner, and professional firm. Today, I'm here to testify about change items to the board. This is the first time the board has asked for a fee increase since 1993. The board has 2 change item requests. Number one is to increase the spending authority to continue to provide the services we provide, additional funding of $100,000 in fiscal year 2026 and $100,000 in each subsequent year from the state government special revenue fund to help address operating cost increases at the board. This will allow us to address rising cost pressures and mitigate impacts to current levels of service and information to the public. Number two, we need to raise fees to cover the increase in our spending authority. This change item request is raising fees collected by the board to cover statutorily mandated operating expenses. Again, fees have not been increased in 32 years. The board is entirely fee supported and receives no general fund dollars to support its services. Rising rates in rent, salaries, technology, legal services, and other costs of doing business have resulted in a growing gap between revenues and expenditures. Finally, many of the board's fees are still written in Minnesota rules and need to be moved into statutes. The approval of our 2 change items will enable the board to maintain core public safety responsibilities, including efficient licensing, managing complaints, and maintaining a balanced budget as required by state law. Thank you for the opportunity to present today.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. Questions? Representative Levy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's more of a general comment. I'm just kind of blown away that these boards haven't come in to ask for a fee increase in so many years. It's just kind of mind-boggling. I don't know how this has happened. I think members may or may not understand kind of how this works, and Mr. Harney was sort of explaining it. You know, this is not general fund. They are essentially charging fees to support their operations. And so there has to be a balance. And so I'm just really not understanding, unless it's that there's been such growth in the number of licensees. And you're shaking your head, so maybe that's what it is. But it seems like very strange practice to wait 25 or 27 years or whatever it is, and then come in and ask for a big fee increase. It would make a little more sense to come in every 2 or 3 years and ask for a little bit of an increase? Just a comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Other questions or comments from members? Representative DePell.
In your opinion, what is the cause for the need to come in and ask for increases?
Director Petty. Is that right?
Thank you. Petty, yes.
Petty, okay, thank you.
Like Piddle with no L.
Thank you for a clarification.
Of course.
The inquiring minds wanted to know.
Chair Backer and members of the committee, I've been in this position for 2 years. That's why I'm shaking my head. I wish I had a better answer. I agree with your thoughts.
Okay. Any follow-up there?
She's here now.
Exactly. I am here now. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Gilman.
I'm good.
You're good. Okay.
Great. Thanks.
One thing before we go, we see you over there. Our community administrator did email out the budget books to all the members. So FYI. And then we're back to Representative Liebling.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I didn't hear that, I didn't hear before until way into the conversation on the previous presenter, like, what is the fee now and what is the fee that you want to raise it?
Okay.
Go ahead, Director.
Chair Backer and Representative Liebling. So in the budget item, there are listed fees, and you'll see those there in that change item. We hope to raise, there's several fees we're changing. 14 of the fees will be increased. An additional 6 will be increased by default based on their current and proposed language. 1 fee is redundant and should be repealed.
Did that? Any follow-up?
Thank you. Sorry, Mr. Chair. I didn't hear it. I mean, I guess there are a bunch of them, so you can't just kind of reel off the numbers, but give us an idea, like, what is the fee right now just for a basic chiropractor license, and
Absolutely.
What will it be after the change?
Go ahead, Director.
Thank you. Chair Backer, Representative Liebling. So for an initial doctor of chiropractic license, the current fee is $250, and the proposed increase would be to $300, okay? The registrations, acupuncture, animal chiropractic, are currently, they vary. Some are 100, some are 125, some are 150, and we're trying to make those all the same at 200. For renewals of licenses, current renewal fee for a chiropractic license is 200, and the proposed fee would be 250. That was really the one that I was hoping to not affect those licensed chiropractors in good standing. I want to affect them the least, but that is where we generate the majority of our revenue from. The other registration renewals will also increase. They were, again, all over the board, $50 to $75 or $100, and we're going to have those all just standard at $100 is what we've proposed.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, anybody? Oh, Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Petty, I just have to ask regarding the animal chiropractic medicine. Just wondering how long that has been part of this organization's oversight, and why is it not in being done through veterinary hospitals or care?
Go ahead, Director.
Thank you, Chair Backer and Representative. So the animal chiropractic has been an opportunity for chiropractors for several years. I apologize. I don't know the exact date. I believe it's around 20 years. I can get that information for you. But there is also, we have statutory language and rules that require that an individual who has a chiropractic license and an animal chiropractic registration is required to have a referral from a veterinary provider in order to treat that animal.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Director Petty. That gives me a better understanding and more comfort now too. Thanks.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, seeing none. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We have Deb Schumacher, I believe I'm pronouncing that correct. And after that is Juha Yang with Board of Social Work. Please state your name and proceed with your presentation.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Becker, and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Deborah Schumacher, and I'm the Director of Nursing Education at the Board, Minnesota Board of Nursing. I'm honored to be here today in representation of the Board of Nursing for Karen Gaitko, who is our Executive Director. She was not able to be here today, and she sends her best regards. So the mission of the Minnesota Board of Nursing is to protect the public's health and safety through regulation of nursing education, licensure, and practice. We were established in 1907. We're the largest health-regulated licensing board in Minnesota. We're funded solely through licensing fees with no general fund money. We work closely with the Attorney General's office. We are members of both the National Council of State Boards of Nursing and the Council of Health Boards, excuse me. The Board of Nursing has 45 employees and conducts business through four major service areas: licensure, education, nursing practice and complaint resolution, and lastly, compliance. Today, we are fully staffed to support operations. In nursing practice, we establish and conduct a complaint investigation process that is expedient, just, and commensurate with the perceived risk of harm to the public. In education, we uphold standards for nursing education through consultation and survey. In licensing, we assure an ethical and competent nursing workforce through comprehensive credential reviews and provision of a legally defensible nurse license examination. In data, we interface with state, national, and federal agencies and information systems and national nurse and regulatory organizations to analyze and disseminate data for evidence-informed regulatory decisions. Some general changes and enhancements from 2024 to 2025. We hired a director of practice and compliance, hired a director of health policy and research. A new executive director, Karen Gaitko, started in September of 2024, filled an open director of nursing education position, which is myself. There were many open positions at the Board of Nursing at the start of the year. Filling these positions with qualified experts has resulted in building and now maintaining seamless systems from new applicant licensure to complaint resolution in discipline. For our licensure work, in the past, the Board of Nursing has experienced several events that have resulted in the sharp and sudden influx of licensed applicants, such as COVID or the nurse work stoppage. In the past year, we have strengthened and built upon existing processes to support the timely processing of licensure. And these actions include, but are not limited to, enhanced data systems that promote online license processing capabilities, fully staffed licensing department. We license LPNs, RNs, and APRNs. We continue to see an increase in the number of RNs and APRNs with current registration in the state and a decrease in LPNs with current registration. There are currently 165,642 nurses in Minnesota with current registration, of which there are 134,648 RNs, 17,887 LPNs, and 13,107 APRNs. In regard to temporary permits, applicants endorsing to Minnesota may request a temporary permit to practice in Minnesota while their application is under review. If they meet the requirements for a temporary permit, the board will issue a permit, which is valid until the board grants a license or for 60 days, whichever comes first. In regarding the National Licensure Compact Act, many states are part of the Nursing Compact. Minnesota is one of the states that currently is not. If this becomes a directive in our state, we will work at the Board of Nursing to operationalize in partnership with our National Council State Boards of Nursing. For compliance and discipline, since January 2024, we continue to average 150 complaints per month. The new director in that position has built solid and robust pathways, assuring timely response to concerns, complaints, and we have implemented the following improvements to process the handling of complaints. We've added the following new positions: two nurse practice specialists, one paralegal, and one legal analyst to improve the capacity to handle the complaints. We have conducted more education for board members and staff around discipline processes. We have begun tracking metrics that have facilitated movement of cases. We've increased the number of monthly conferences to facilitate cases. And our AGO has also, Attorney General's Office, has also added staff to support the Board of Nursing Compliance complaint operations. For education, our general work is to support the mission of the Board of Nursing by developing and implementing the Minnesota Board of Nursing's program approval process. The Education Department is responsive to the quality and patient safety standards in Minnesota nursing education. The Board of Nursing jurisdiction is for pre-licensure nursing programs in the state of Minnesota. There are currently 89 pre-licensure programs, of which there are 23 practical nursing programs, there are 25 associate degree nursing programs, there are 22 baccalaureate nursing programs, and there are 4 entry-level master's nursing programs, and there are 15 advanced practice nurses programs. Minnesota Board of Nursing program approval requires all practical and professional nursing programs to be accredited by a national nursing accrediting body. All of the Minnesota pre-licensure nursing programs in the state are accredited. The board also requires directors of approved nursing programs to submit evidence regarding the nursing program's compliance with relevant approval rules each year. Program approval is granted when programs have met and continue to meet the nursing program standards as set forth in the Minnesota rules. Continuous evaluation and improvement within the program by the nursing director and faculty ensures the quality of the nursing programs. Based on program approval, the board can provide the public and prospective students with a list of approved nursing programs. In Minnesota for 2024, there were a total of 4,248 practical and professional nursing student graduates and a total of 4,158 APRN graduates. To give you a little bit of trending on that, compared to 2019, the number of students completing an associate degree nursing program in 2024 decreased 21.5%. The number of students completing a baccalaureate and entry-level master's program in 2024 increased by 28%. And the number of students completing practical nursing programs in 2024 decreased by 34.8%. The APRN graduates have increased 17%. From 2020 to 2024. And with that, I'll end my presentation and respond to questions. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. And also for all the ones that are presenting, if you could also submit us a written testimony so we have that for the record too for members who ask. First one on questions, Representative Bonner, go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ms. Schumacher, for being here today. So I had a really quick question, and maybe it's a clarifying question to get to my question, but the first is around the numbers of licensed nurses in the state and the trends that you're seeing. And you said there are 134,000 registered nurses, 13,000 advanced practice registered nurses, and then, I'm sorry, I missed the number for the LPNs. Can you tell me what that was?
Go ahead, Ms. Schumacher.
Thank you, Chair Becker and Representative. Yes, the LPN in the state is 17,887. And again, this is in 2024, current data.
Okay. And I think, Mr. Chair.
Representative, go ahead.
Thank you, Ms. Schumacher. And so I think I heard you say that we have been seeing an increase in the number of RNs and APRNs in the state, which might be consistent with seeing the number of nursing students going for those advanced practice degrees. But you also mentioned two things. One, you mentioned that the number of LPNs in the state is decreasing. And for everybody not aware, those are sort of the entry-level nurses. And that the graduates from some of those programs was also going down. And I wonder if you could speak briefly to where you're seeing that shift, downward shift, is that existing nurses are going ahead and getting more education and they're moving up the ladder, and yet there's maybe not enough nursing students coming in to backfill behind them? Or can you speak to maybe what that trend is and why that's happening?
Okay, just to let you know, we have 3 people on the list, and we're going go up to about 10-2 with the nurses, just to keep everybody on track. So go ahead and answer that question there, Ms. Schumacher.
Thank you, Chair Becker and Representative. It's a complex nature of many factors, and I'd love to have a conversation. But in short, there are, yes, some LPNs in considered an entry-level practice then do migrate towards an RN degree. There are also decreasing enrollments in LPN schools that we are looking at to try to work with programs to increase LPNs and retain LPNs. And there's a faculty shortage as well that is in existence for many programs, actually, not only LPNs. So it's a rather complex circumstances that kind of come together. I hope that somewhat answered your question.
Follow up, Representative.
Thank you. And maybe that's, we can take some of that offline as well. I'd love to follow up further on that conversation. One of the things that I know could be impacting that, and I think you mentioned it in your comments, that you were talking about handling different types of complaints. Can you speak to if you've seen an increase in workplace violence complaints from nurses and how that you think that might factor into what you're seeing? And that's my last question.
Thank you. And Ms. Schumacher.
Chair Becker and Representative, thank you. I can't speak in any kind of a confident and comprehensive way to your question today, and I would certainly rely with my colleagues and consult with my colleagues on the connection between workplace violence and complaints that may come in.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Schumacher, for the really good information as I was writing down questions. You were answering most of them as you went. So really impressive the number of programs in the state of Minnesota. I'll just do two questions. One is, you track and license all the nurses working in the state of Minnesota. My question is, do you track on a given year or a month, do you know how many are here and are licensed that are not employed at a given time?
Ms. Schumacher.
Thank you, Chair Becker and Representative. That data does exist, and I don't have it right at my fingertips, but I was actually looking at some of that data earlier today, and I don't want to misquote, but there are, and it's on, there's national information on that as well as state, but there are, I don't think the Board of Nursing tracks that specifically, but that data does exist, and there are nurses in the state that are registered and may not be working, or have a current registration and may not be working.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One more question,
okay,
then. This is kind of relates to traveling nurses, but you know, I presume you have oversight all over any nurse working in the state, and they would have to register with you. You mentioned that they would get a temporary license if they qualified, and then it would take 60 days, perhaps, to get the license. Is that a pretty a number that you hit within 60 days, or does it take longer than that?
Ms. Schumacher.
Chair Becker and Representative, for this question, I do not know the answer, and I would need to consult with our licensing director and staff, and we can get that information to you.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Representative Zalesnikar.
Thank you, Chair. I think it's on. Thank you, Chair, and thank you for your testimony. I was going to ask follow-up on the question, too, on your data that you have for tracking, because we have nurses that are coming in that are licensed in other states coming to Minnesota for an opportunity, wondering exactly the five-year trend of how timely we've been on issuing nurse license in the state of Minnesota. And from my conversations with the Board of Nursing, that was problematic a few years ago, and it's gotten better, but it ebbs and flows to Rep. Bierman's point on how many pool staff are coming into the state, and then how many people are moving into the state from other states where you are doing licensing again. And so I think that would be very helpful to have that data for this committee to see a trend for the last 5 years on timeliness of license, because it's problematic for a hospital, especially critical access when they're limited, if they've hired somebody and they're waiting, or any hospital or nursing home or 24-hour operation to be waiting when you have a licensed nurse who's been trained, passed a license in this state or another state, but needs to have this done. So thank you.
Ms. Schumacher.
Chair Backer, Representative, thank you. And was there a question in that? I made notes that you're interested in that data, and I can get that information back to you.
Clarify that, please.
Thank you, Chair. Yeah, the question is just getting the data to this committee on the actual data of timeliness. How many nurse licenses were done in 60 days or under for the last 5 years? How many were not?
And Ms. Schumacher, you'll get that data for Representative.
I will. Okay. Thank you, Chair Becker and Representative.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you. Final question is from Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Chair Becker, and thank you, Ms. Schumacher. I have one quick one, and I think one a little bit not quite so quick. But you had mentioned, and correct me if I misheard, that you hired a director of health policy and research. Can you tell me a little bit about the responsibilities of that with the Board of Nursing and why that would be necessary?
Ms. Schumacher.
Chair Becker and Representative, thank you for that question. I am going to defer that question to my executive director to answer that as best possible. I do believe that position, it is new, and I do believe it is in development, and yet she can respond with more information about that
offline,
how it's developing.
Okay. Great. You had another question, Representative Nadeau.
Yes, and you mentioned in three different occasions in your testimony about complaints. And I was just looking at the data, and historically it took 321 days to resolve a complaint in 22, 345 days to resolve a complaint in 23. There were 750 complaints in 22 and over 1,200 in 23. So you're getting many more complaints, and they're taking much, much longer, almost a year, to resolve. Can you talk a little bit about, is that typical? I mean, that's a long time to be spending a lot of money to resolve complaints. Can you talk about that?
Ms. Schumacher.
Chair Becker and Representative, thank you. I can talk a little bit about it, and to have a more comprehensive response, again, I think our executive director could get more information back to you. I've been at the board a year, and I have understood and come to understand that we have that history, and that we are, as was spoken to in some of this, as far as staffing, hiring staffing, increasing processes. So our current rate of responding to complaints is decreasing. And I'll have to leave it at that for today, but we can get more information and a response to that.
Okay, we are off. Thank you, Ms. Schumacher. We are off to Board of Social Work, Juya Yang. I'm going to go Ms. Yang, okay? Thank you. And then after that, we have Samuel Sands after Ms. Yang. Please state your name and your testimony. Keep it to 5 minutes, please. Presentation, okay. I should say, for 5 minutes.
Sounds good. My name is Jua Yang, and thank you, Chair Backer and members of the committee. I'm the executive director for the Minnesota Board of Social Work, and our mission is to protect the public through licensing regulation of the social work profession and ensuring that there are qualified professional, ethical, and accountable social workers serving the community. Our primary responsibility are to clearly license social workers, investigate, resolve complaints, and we do public education. And with our board, we've licensed over 18,000 social work licensees, and we have four standard license types that we license them in, one in a bachelor's level and three at a master's level. We also have two pathways to try to get to our standard license. So our exam pathway, which somebody
graduates and can take the exam and obtain a standard license with us. Effective as of October 1, 2024, we passed a provisional licensure pathway, which in lieu of the exam, someone could do complete supervision and supervised practice hours to obtain a standard license. We have clearly, because it's just starting, we're starting to see a increase in that in licensure type. And in addition, I said we also do education. We do a really robust education to our higher education. And so we have staff who go out to bachelor's level, master's level program and educate graduating students to ensure they're aware of when to get licensure options and when to, it's complicated when to start that process and when to get that in place. I am here today actually to testify about our change item, which is to add the social work compact fees. The last legislative session, the social work compact fees did pass, and the social work compact has been enacted with 22 states. And we're projecting about a 12 to 24 months before operationalizing it. I call it multi-state license because one of the things that's different about the social work compact is we are collecting these fees from Minnesota licensees. So it's not privileged to practice from individuals coming to practice within our state where we are collecting the fees. And that overall we are asking for although we are not operationalized, that we anticipate that we will have costs associated with this, such as implementing a database for this, staff costs that will come into testing the system, getting it to be operationalized. And so by adding the multi-state fees, it will enable the board to offset some of the expenses related to processing and issuing these multi-state licenses. And the fees we anticipate will be in effect when our multi-state license is ready to be issued or when our state is ready to operationalize issuing multi-state license. So I thank you for your time and allowing me to share about the board and our compact fees, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Director Yang. We have Representative Ryer. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Director Yang. I have a couple of questions. The first is just curiosity about the alternative pathway that was just put in place. What have you done, what have you needed to do in terms of defining the process that you now follow, and how's it going in terms of bringing people along that way and cutting down some of the barriers to licensure?
Director Yang.
Sure. Chair Backer, Representative. First and foremost, I think we've we've hosted educational session to talk about just we call it provisional license and all the eligibility, criteria as well. It has, since it launched on October 1st to about January, we've had about 326 applications, that are that we've received for that alternative pathway. And we anticipated that the majority, when we received them early on, were individuals who were struggling to pass the licensure exam. And so that's been the bulk of the majority of our applicants, but it's kind of transitioned. And just also, although we have this alternative pathway, the exam pathway is still the most sought out, where we receive the highest number of applicants as well at this time.
One follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, one follow-up just on the temporary license applicants, which, as I understand it, is a transition from when someone graduates to when they have their licensure in place and there's a piece to tide people over. How is that going? What's the turnaround time on processing those? Any information you could share about that, please?
Director Yang.
Chair Backer, Representative. Temporary license issue is, just for clarification, it's different from provisional license in that temporary license is effective for 6 months and it's for, it could be for students who are in in programs that are in candidacy in which they would like a temporary license while their program is going through the accreditation process, or when they are from another jurisdiction and they've not been licensed before, or as students. And our biggest number of applicants for a temporary license are actually students from candidacy programs. And I feel like if we get the documentation to support, such as passing the exam, so our turnaround time in terms of processing applications are, I would say, at most within a week if we get all the documentation. Sometimes it could be due to whether or not we get, like, the transcript or the, you know, exam scores for us to process that information.
Any other? Okay, we are, thank you, Director Yang. We appreciate that. Now we have Director Sand, and then after that we have Director Hagelin. So as you come to the table, please share your name and proceed.
Chair Backer, members of the committee. My name is Sam Sands. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Board of Psychology, and we're also the administering board for the Health Professional Services Program, which I'll refer to probably as HPSP. So the board's mission is to protect the public through licensure, regulation, and education to promote access to safe, competent, and ethical psychological services. The board currently licenses and regulates about 3,700 psychologists and almost 600 behavior analysts. Psychologists are mental health professionals that they're currently licensed at the doctoral level. And those licensees are eligible for CIPACT, which is of course the interstate compact regulating the practice of psychology that's currently operational in 42 states. So the board's functions are to license qualified individuals as psychologists or behavior analysts, to renew those licenses, to accept and investigate and adjudicate complaints related to its licensees or violations of the Practice Act, and then to monitor compliance should discipline be agreed to or imposed. Finally, we educate the public about the role of the board in regulating the practice of psychology and or behavior analysis. The board also plays a part in making sure that rural and underserved communities get access to services. The board does this in part by its actions, especially related to telehealth, I'll highlight in this meeting. The board signals its support of telehealth through its support of CIPACT when it went through the legislature in 2021. As well as its statutes and rules that empower psychologists to use their professional judgment with respect to the services that can be provided via telehealth means. With respect to CIPAC, Minnesota is a net recipient of psychological services as provided through CIPAC. That is that more out-of-state licensed psychologists are providing services into Minnesota than Minnesota psychologists that have signed up to provide services into other states. About 457 individuals reported that they have provided services into Minnesota through CIPACT in the last year. So that's about 14% of our licensing population is an increase. And then CIPACT reports that about 25% of those, their practicing psychologists, are providing services into rural communities. And while 89% of our psychologists are based in the metro area, the Minnesota Department of Health collects data about our licensees, and they've reported to us that 6 in 10 psychologists say that at least 25% of their services are provided in a telehealth setting, and that about 40% of the individuals say that 50% or more of their practice is in a telehealth setting. And then in addition to that, on top, since July 1, the board has had responsibility for administering the license for behavior analysts. And since then, we've licensed almost 600 behavior analysts in the state of Minnesota. It's a new license type. And due to our staff's hard work, we've rolled up these licensing functions into our day-to-day operations after a ramp-up of about 6 months to get them going. In addition to regulating the practice of psychology, the board also serves as the administering program for the Health Professional Services Program. HPSP protects the public through monitoring services to regulated healthcare professionals whose illness may impact their ability to practice safely. Or to put it another way, HPSP holds licensed healthcare professionals accountable to their own illnesses in order to protect Minnesotan citizens. HPSP monitors approximately 1.5% of our licensed healthcare professionals. These are all of our licensed healthcare professionals, which is about 520 people. And the most common illnesses include alcohol use, drug use, as well as anxiety, depression, and PTSD. Referrals for this program can come from licensees themselves, third parties, coworkers, supervisors, or the board. About 50% of the monitored individuals live in the metro area, and the other 50% are in greater Minnesota providing safe monitored care. Almost all of the participants are seeing Minnesota licensed providers to treat their underlying conditions. And I'd just like to say that the HPSP program is an important way that the boards regulate their respective professions by giving us tools to monitor illness, the illness of our licensees, while holding them accountable to their illness while they're continuing to provide safe services to Minnesotans. Thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, we're going to start with Representative Nadeau. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Backer, or Chair Backer. Can you tell me, there's a significant increase in your operating costs over from 24 to 25 and then continuing to 26 and 27. Is there some correction that was made last year between 24 and 25? Can you just explain that to me? It's significant. It's like 45%. Thanks.
Yes, Director Sands.
Chair Backer, Representative Nadeau. Yes, so this is part of it. This is part of the board taking on HPSP as the administering board. So in years past, it's been the medical board. And then in the last legislative session, the psychology board stepped up to take over administering that function. And with that, we got their budget, which is the 45% that you're talking about. So they have a budget of their own that's also funded by the health licensing boards. So I took on their budget as well. So that's why there was a 45% increase.
Follow up?
And there was also an increase in their operating budget as well, in that board's budget, of about the same. So I'm just curious, if you look on the change pages, and I might be reading this wrong, so my apologies, but and we can follow up later. I'm just really curious as to that bump. That's all. And I will reach out to you offline.
Director, do you have a comment with it? No, okay. Now we go to Representative Carroll.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for your testimony. So my question is on the interstate compact, and how does that work with regard to providers coming in? Is it on a limited, one-time basis, or is it a continuing engagement where they're essentially practicing here, establishing the practice here from out of state?
Director Sand.
Chair Backer, Representative Carroll. There are two ways that they can provide services into Minnesota. There is a telepsychology. So from their home state, they can provide teleservices into Minnesota. Oftentimes that's used for transition of care, continuity of care. Somebody moves here, they want to transition them to a Minnesota licensed psychologist or provider. They can do it that way. or if they have a student who comes home from school on break here over the summer, they can see that client over the summer. That's the main way that I think that it's being used. And then in addition, there is a limited in-person privilege that they can take for 30 days, but it's not a continual use.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, seeing none. Thank you, Director Sand.
Thank you very much.
We have a Director Hagelin next, and then following that will be Director Huntley. Please state your name and proceed with your presentation.
Good afternoon, Chair Becker and representatives. My name is Britt Hagelin. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Optometry, which many of you may not have heard of before.
Sure.
I'm the Executive Director with the Minnesota Board of Optometry.
We hear you better now. Thank you.
Great. Minnesota was the first in the nation to have an optometry board, which was established in 1901. So we've been around a long time. We are just here to provide and protect the public through licensure, compliance, and education. We happen to be one of the very smallest boards. I'm not here for a fee increase or anything like that, but our budget is minute, a little over $250,000 with just two part-time employees. And our goal in for the board is to provide the best customer service for both our licensees and for the public at large. We meet quarterly with five doctors and two public members to discuss operations and any complaints that may arise during the time between. We have incredible professionals serving on our board right now and who have been active nationally. And Minnesota is recognized as a leader in governance of optometry, although not a leader in the laws. To become an optometrist, for those that might not know, you must complete 4 years of postgraduate instruction and then pass a series of national exams. Currently, we have 1,261 optometrists in the state. We have no other types of licensees with this board. We don't have temporary licenses, anything like that. You're either in or you're out. About 75% of Minnesotans see an optometrist, and I can see just visually in the room that you know that. And they typically are the first line of defense when you're concerned about your eye care health. This past session, we had some bills introduced, and they weren't able to proceed, but I'm hoping this session we will be able to move forward with some of the legislation. I will say Minnesota lags behind almost all the other states and absolutely all of our neighboring states on many of the procedures they're able to do. Mm-hmm. I am not an optometrist, but the things that have been proposed in the last two sessions are to bring us up to the bare minimum of standards mm-hmm. that our neighboring states already have and most of the nation. They're not controversial items. There have been none or very little documentation of any adverse effects by allowing our optometrists to do what they were trained to do. And as a matter of fact, many of the optometry graduates today choose not to come to Minnesota because we have such a limited scope. However, the optometrists that we do have very rarely have any complaints and work well with the board for any suggestions. That's all I have for you today.
Okay, thank you. We are going to go to Representative Bierman. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Hagelin, for being here today. I wanted to ask about the numbers. I think I heard you say 1,200 optometrists, but I had some data that was significantly higher than that, so I just wanted to just double check.
We have 1,261.
Go ahead, Director.
Yes, Chair and Representative. We have 1,261 optometrists currently licensed in Minnesota, so 1,261.
follow up there, Rep?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair. Ahead. So I wonder how that compares to, do you have any data on like previous years?
Director.
Are we going up, down?
Yes, Chair and Representative. We slowly increase about 1% a year, if that, which isn't keeping up with our population at all. So it's a slow increase. We license approximately 60 to 70 new doctors a year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just two follow more small things. I appreciated knowing about the very few complaints. I had data that was similar, very few complaints. And I wanted to just ask, so we don't have a school of optometry. Do you track where the optometrists come from or the schools that we're getting them from at this point? Can you say with any certainty about the schools where we're attracting people?
Yeah, Director Hagelin, go ahead.
I don't have that data with me, but we can tell from where they graduate. There are about 17 schools around the country, the nearest one being in Illinois. Many are in more temperate climates, for lack of a better word, but we can track where they graduate from as part of the licensure process, if that's something you're interested in.
Okay. Thank you. That would be interesting detail. And just I'll just close up and just thank you for being here today and to talk a little bit about this. And I appreciated some of the, you know, you answered some of my questions about, you know, what the difficulty of getting people to come to Minnesota are regarding scope. And appreciated those comments as well. Thank you.
Okay. And our final questions for this will be from Representative Liebling. Go ahead.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so the mission, as with all the boards, is to protect the public through the regulation of the profession. And I don't recall another board coming in and really lobbying to change the scope of practice of the people who are being regulated. And today's hearing, to my understanding, is not to talk about the scope bills, you know, without expressing any opinion about those bills, but I honestly just think that's pretty inappropriate for your board, and I know that we all got a letter from the board also lobbying to change the scope of practice of the practitioners, and I just want to express my opinion that I found that very inappropriate. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have Representative Van Binsbergen. Go ahead, please.
Thank you for your testimony. Very helpful today. Appreciate your comments. It sounds like you're running a really good organization and appreciate your service. My question is in regards to rural Minnesota. And, you know, I know my wife is a pharmacist, and there's a huge shortage of pharmacists, especially out in the rural area. What's going on with optometrists in rural Minnesota, and is there an equal shortage?
Go ahead, Director.
Currently, we are able to meet most of the needs. I don't have the exact numbers on who is serving in the rural communities, but the nice thing about optometry is in Minnesota, we do permit teleoptometry, which opens up quite a few options for folks that are not in the metro area. However, there is anecdotally from retiring optometrists, there is a fair difficulty in replacing both their practices and having optometrists join their practices.
Okay. In follow the rural up, areas. Representative. Okay. Well, thank you so much. We appreciate you coming here and sharing us what's important to you and your profession. So with that said, we have Director Huntley on, and then we have Deputy Executive Director Dr. Howard after that. And we have 25 minutes, so about 5-minute presentation there, and that way we can get through everybody. So go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you. Chair Backer, committee members, good afternoon. My name is Elizabeth Huntley, and I am the Executive Director for the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice. The mission of the Minnesota Board of Medical Practice is to protect the public's health and safety by assuring that the people who practice medicine or as an allied profession are competent,
ethical practitioners with the necessary knowledge and skills appropriate to their title and role. The Minnesota Board of Medical Practice was established in 1883 and is the longest standing healthcare board in the state. The structure of the medical board is that we have 16 members. 11 of those members are physicians and 5 of those board members are public members. Each board member can serve 2 consecutive terms, and those terms are 4 years. There is at least 1 physician member from each of the 8 congressional districts, and the 5 public members represent 5 of the 8 congressional districts in the state of Minnesota. The majority of the board's work is done through committees. Each board member serves on 1 of 4 committees, and the board itself meets at least 6 times a year to conduct its annual or its required business meetings. In addition to physicians, the Board of Medical Practice regulates 7 allied professions. They include acupuncturists, athletic trainers, genetic counselors, traditional midwives, naturopathic doctors, physician assistants, and respiratory therapists. Each allied profession has an advisory council that includes members of the profession, public members, and physician members, and the charge of those advisory councils is to advise the board on matters related to those professions. Regarding licensing, all 8 professions under the board's regulation can, and the vast majority do, submit their initial application for licensure online. They also can all complete their annual renewals online. We currently have just over 40,000 healthcare providers under the Board of Medical Practices regulation. Approximately 75%, just over 29,000 of those are physicians. And of those physicians, about 30% are in the greater 9 county metro area. We have an additional about 12% in Olmsted County. The medical board does also have a registration for telemedicine that does allow for a physician to provide medical services to patients located in Minnesota through this interstate telehealth registration when certain conditions are met. A couple of those include that the physician is not allowed to open an office in Minnesota nor treat patients directly in the state. Minnesota is part of 2 interstate licensing compacts through the board. One is for physicians and the other is for physician assistants. The physician compact has been operational since 2017, and the physician assistant compact had its legislation passed just last year and is in the process of forming its operations after the threshold minimum of 7 states passing the model legislation was met last year. There are 42 participating states and territories in the physician compact, and I'm happy to share that one of our current board members is the chair of the Interstate Medical Licensure Compact this year. Last year in 2024, just shy of 38% of newly licensed physicians in Minnesota qualified for their licensure through that Interstate Medical Licensure Compact. The Minnesota Board of Medical Practice also accepts and investigates complaints against all of the regulated professionals under its regulation. The board also is authorized to take corrective and disciplinary action against a license when it determines that such an action is appropriate. Both corrective and disciplinary actions are public and are available on the board's website. The Board of Medical Practice, similar to most of our sister and brother boards, is fully self-funded through the application and renewal fees that it accepts. And with that, I will close my testimony and am available for any questions.
Thank you, Director. Questions? We're speechless with you there, Director. Okay, well, thank you. We appreciate your time and sharing that information. What we are going to do next is, because we have 2 from the Board of Pharmacy, we're going to let them both speak, and then we'll take the questions. So we're going to first have Dr. Howard, and then after that, Dr. Reed. And then both of you can stay up there for questions, please. And then, of course, state your name for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Chair Backer and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Katrina Howard, and I am the Deputy Director at the Board of Pharmacy. My name is Dr. Brock Reed. I am the Controlled Substance Reporting Section Director at the Board. One of the programs that I oversee is the Minnesota Prescription Monitoring Program, or PMP. We are here today to present the Board of Pharmacy's budget request.
And Dr. Howard, can you pull your mic up a little bit? Yeah, no, just closer to you. Thank you.
Sure. The Board of Pharmacy is a health licensing board that was established in 1885. Its mission is to promote, preserve, and protect public health and safety by fostering the safe distribution of pharmaceuticals and the provision of quality pharmaceutical care to the citizens of Minnesota. The board accomplishes this mission of protecting the public through the licensing and regulation of its licensees. Each year, the board licenses or registers over 26,000 individuals and facilities. These include more than 9,900 pharmacists, over 10,000 pharmacy technicians, more than 2,100 pharmacies, 1,100 drug manufacturers, 750 wholesale distributors, 900 pharmacy interns, and so on. In addition to licensing, the legislature has also assigned five programs under the Board of Pharmacy's regulatory oversight. These include the Medication Repository Program, the Insulin Safety Net Program, the Insulin Registration Fee Program, and the two programs which comprise the Controlled Substance Reporting Section, which are the Prescription Monitoring Program and the Opiate Product Registration Fee Program. The board itself is comprised of 9 board members appointed by the governor, 6 of which are licensed practicing pharmacists, and 3 are public members. There are 23 board staff that carry out the day-to-day operation of the Board of Pharmacy. The board is seeking 2 main requests. The first is to extend the availability of previously appropriated general fund dollars for ongoing legal costs through fiscal year 27. In fiscal year 24, the board received a one-time appropriation of $1.5 million, which is currently set to expire on June 30th, 2025. These funds were appropriated to cover legal expenses related to the lawsuit filed in 2020 concerning the Insulin Safety Net Program, Pharma versus Williams. Importantly, this request does not involve additional funding. Instead, it asks for permission to continue using the remaining funds from the original appropriation through fiscal year 27, as legal expenses are expected to continue into the next biennium. Furthermore, currently the board's appropriation is set to reduce in fiscal year 26. If a reduction does occur, the board will not have the funds to maintain its existing operation. Therefore, the second request is to increase the board's fiscal year 26 and fiscal year 27 spending authority by approximately $1.2 million to maintain its staffing and service level. Aside from extraordinary circumstances like the lawsuit from Pharma, the board is otherwise a self-funded agency and has sufficient revenue to cover the increase in spending authority being requested for its daily operation. The increase in spending authority is best broken down into 3 parts. I'll explain the first 2, and then Dr. Reed will explain the third. The first is to maintain the board's existing operation, for which the requested annual spending authority increase is $905,000. There are numerous drivers necessitating the increase. First, the state's IT department minute has quoted the board an annual increase of $151,000 to maintain services for our small agency. This includes rate-based services, shared costs for 3-minute full-time employees, and maintenance of the board's licensing system. The board cannot absorb $151,000 without increasing its spending authority. The board's rules, last significantly revised in 2011, are another driver necessitating the increase in appropriation. Given the complexity and size of the board's rules, the revisions needed, stakeholder feedback, and anticipated hearings at the Office of Administrative Hearings, the board requests an increase in spending authority of $75,000. Thirdly, the board has historically operated with a lean appropriation, and last biennium, the board experienced tremendous transition. Notably, at the start of the biennium, the board was fortunate to migrate to a new licensing system enjoyed by 14 other health licensing boards. In doing so, the board was able to offer online renewals for the first time ever to pharmacies, manufacturers, drug wholesalers, third-party logistics providers, and medical gas dispensers. Furthermore, during this time, the board has not been untouched by transitions in the workforce that many others experienced post-pandemic. In the last 2 years alone, the board has hired a licensure supervisor, associate director of enforcement, an executive assistant, a legal analyst, 3 licensing specialists, and 1 senior licensing specialist. 5 of these positions were backfills, while 3 of them were created to help bring stability amid significant demands and transition in our small agency. However, during this time, the board has lacked sufficient spending authority to backfill a critical pharmacist surveyor position. To maintain our existing personnel and hire the pharmacist surveyor, the board requests roughly $650,000 of spending authority. The last significant driver of the $905,000 increase in spending authority to maintain the board's operation is the lien appropriation that the board has historically operated with. In fiscal year 25, the fixed expenses of rent, staff, and IT services are consuming more than 84% of the board's operational appropriation. Without the requested increase, the board's appropriation is currently set to decrease in fiscal year 26, and the fixed expenses of staff, rent, and IT will consume over 90% of the operational budget. This will leave insufficient funds for other critical operational needs. All of this said, it's imperative for the board to receive an increase in spending authority so it can maintain its current staffing and service level. The second part of the board's request is to increase the spending authority for the purpose of enhancing the board's operation by hiring an investigator senior position to improve the efficiency and resolution of complaint investigations. Presently, pharmacy surveyors handle both in-state pharmacy inspections and complaint investigations. Not all complaints require the expertise of a licensed pharmacist, and hiring a non-clinical investigator will allow the board to build out its enforcement unit and enhance investigative efficiency. This change will also enable pharmacy surveyors to focus more on facility inspections, which will increase the number of inspections completed annually. For this part, the board requests an increase in annual spending authority of $142,000.
The third prong of this request focuses on maintaining the service level of the Minnesota Prescription Monitoring Program, or PMP, through increasing its annual spending authority by $150,000. Since its inception in 2010, the PMP has been a secure electronic database managed by the Board of Pharmacy, where pharmacies report their dispensations of controlled substances. It serves as a clinical tool for prescribers and pharmacists to consult when considering prescribing or dispensing controlled substances to patients. The PMP is a statewide program with over 37,000 active account holders, including physicians, physician assistants, nurse practitioners, pharmacists, and dentists. The board is requesting this increase in annual spending authority to enable the board the ability to renew the statewide license, the statewide integration license, and maintain current services. This proposal would allow the board to continue facilitating the integration of Minnesota PMP reports into clinical software through eliminating implementation and recurring fees for Minnesota healthcare facilities. Removing these financial barriers ensures greater access for healthcare providers, including those in rural areas, to this time-saving feature and reducing disparities in access. Use of the PMP has increased year over year with around 7 million unique searches conducted in 2024, over 75% of which were performed through integrated access. A survey administered in 2021 found that over 3/4 of providers with PMP accounts agreed with the statement, "The loss of integrated access would impact my ability to perform timely and well-informed patient care." We recognize that this has been a lot of information and are happy to try and answer any questions you or committee members may have. Thank you again, Chair Backer and members of the committee, for the opportunity to present today.
Okay, thank you. First on deck, Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here to talk about this and giving us the overview of the Board of Pharmacy. I appreciate it. On the last point, I just had a few questions on the PMP. And the $150,000 additional dollars would be for each year ahead, is that right? Each year, or is that a 2-year? Or is that adding into the base permanently?
Per year.
Per year. Okay, and then question, you spoke about the physicians and the PAs and the dentists that have that access to it. I just wanted to confirm that there's no other access to that information, PMP, like from law enforcement, no, or even health plans, they can't look at that.
Director Reed.
Thank you, Chair and Representative. Correct, the electronic access is only through for providers, basically.
Okay. And then is it just for Minnesota, or if the neighboring states have the same platform, can they access that as well?
Director Reed, go ahead.
Correct. They can access it as long as we have an interstate sharing agreement.
Okay.
Be able to.
And then, so it lists a certain number of controlled substance prescriptions reported to the PMP. How many or what percentage are not reported?
Director Reed.
Chairman and Representative, that is something we're unable to tell because we can't know what's not reported.
Sure, okay.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that's all I have for the moment. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the board for presenting today. And I don't know if, you know, we're hearing from a lot of different boards, but this one is a little different because you not only regulate providers, in other words, you license pharmacists, but you also regulate pharmacies. And so I just want to make sure everybody knows that you have a really broad, very important role. And some years ago, for example, there was an outbreak of, I can't remember now, something's a disease through compounding. There was a really bad incident where, and this was from out-of-state pharmacies, and I know we changed the board's rules so that you could go and inspect. I just want to say for everyone, there's a really important role here in keeping Minnesotans safe that's really direct. So I appreciate all of that. Just on the prescription monitoring program, I also wanted to flag for those who may be new that the this has been a controversial program from the get-go, bipartisanly controversial, because what it's doing is every time you get a prescription or any Minnesotan gets a prescription for an opiate, even if, you know, your dentist gives you an opiate for a toothache, it gets entered into this database, your personal information with your name, with your address, and there it is. And so this was something that, and still is, kind of controversial. And I know in the last round, budget round, the board wanted to have general fund money to help support the prescription monitoring program, and we did not do that. And so I'm not sure what you're asking for now is to do this with fee revenue. Am I right? Could you just explain, like, is this pharmacists whose fees are going to support this, not the physicians, right? Or obviously, because you don't have jurisdiction over physicians. So are you planning to do this increase with licensing fees from pharmacists? And how much is that bump going to be that they will pay to use to support this service?
Go ahead, either two, but it looks like Mr. Reed wants to answer.
Thank you, Chair and Representative Liebling. It's a good question. The prescription monitoring program is paid for through an appropriation that's spread throughout the boards that license providers. So the physicians, physician assistants, so the medical board, the dentistry board, and the pharmacy board, as well as the nursing board.
Representative Follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And so can you give me an idea, like, is it the same amount for all of these different groups that's being added on to their fees to support this? Or, you know, kind of explain to me, like, so just to, you know, give a little more background to my question here. So when this program was initially established, it was sort of advertised as a way to help with the addiction problem, right, to stop the opioid crisis. And it's had a lot of mission creep over the years. And so now you'll see in the materials it's sort of put out there as a practice tool, not as a way to help stop the opioid epidemic. And it's never been shown. In fact, the opioid epidemic has kind of moved on from this idea that people were doing this through doctor shopping and that it was a prescribing problem. Right now it's more, you know, maybe people still do get addicted from having over-prescribing of opioids, but it's just, it's not a huge piece any longer of what the opioid epidemic is, even though it's still a very serious epidemic. So it's now considered a practice tool. And so it's convenience for doctors and other prescribers who might want to check, but and I know that this isn't the time to talk about all this, but it's just had a lot of mission creep, and there's even There might even be another effort to actually repeal the whole thing because it really hasn't delivered on its promise as it was originally formulated. But my real question to you is just like how much are people being asked to pay to, you know, is it an addition of $50 a year or is it, are we talking $5 a year for a practitioner?
Director Reed.
And Representative, the amount, when it's spread out throughout the boards, is also proportional based on how many providers that each board license, and it would end up being somewhere around $2 or less per provider per year.
Thank you.
Okay. We have no other questions, so thank you. Okay, members, thank for all the boards to come in. Again, Mr. Carter emailed out budget books to all the members, so that should be sitting in your email box. And we've gotten through all the boards. Are there any final comments or questions for any boards? Okay, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is really for you, Moore. So there's another board that's the Unlicensed Complementary and Alternative Healthcare Practice. This is under the Department of Health. And so there's a lot of the professions that we don't license, but they're still regulated. And I just wanted to put that on your radar and suggest that at some point it would be really good to have them come in as well and make a presentation about kind of what their process is because, you know, we heard from the boards that their mission is to keep the public safe and but there is this sort of other beast that lives alongside that whole process that also is regulating alternative and complementary healthcare practitioners. So I just wanted to put that out there and for you, Mr. Chair, to think about bringing them in as well so that we could hear kind of how they, what's the compare and contrast of what they do.
Sure. Thank you for that suggestion. Okay. Seeing no further business before the committee, our next hearing is this Wednesday, March 5th. And with that, we are adjourned. Thank you.